we were at the end of a dirt road in a very secluded area. And I sent all my kids downstairs and told them to hide under the stairs, keep the baby with them. In this process, I also grabbed another cell phone and called my husband, who worked a couple of miles away. And he started heading towards the house. As I was on the phone with him, I looked up and I saw the car that had been described to me, a silver van, coming down the road.
Hey, gang, you ever watch one of these videos on the main channel where someone, a self-defender who's not a cop, just a regular person, gets into a defensive encounter with a firearm and wonder, hey, I wonder what happened after that? We recommend Firearms Legal Protection because they're there so you can win the fight after the fight. You're able to carry on with your life, and it's a defensive legal membership company that ASP recommends. They're committed to helping to train and educate self-defense community, and that's why they're invested in bringing these educational and training videos to you and the podcast. Please thank them for their support and consider them for your needs. Check their plans out at get-asp.com/FLP. get-asp.com/FLP. All right, folks, welcome back. This is the Active Self-Protection Podcast, and I am your host, Mike Williver, your favorite
former
Fed. With me today is our friend. You know her, you've seen her on the main channel. She is our CEO. She is the mama bear of Active Self-Protection, Stephanie Widener. Stephanie, how are you?
Hi, Mike. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. So Stephanie was able to put Cody in a locked container in the yard for an hour so we could talk, and I really appreciate that, by the way, because he is a handful. We love Cody.
Me on a phone or on any type of interview is just his cue to come in and start messing with me. He would love to come in and say hi and just have a big part in all of this.
Yeah, so, like when the kids are little and, you know, you're on the phone, mom, mama, mommy,
right,
mama.
Right.
Yeah.
It has not gotten better with him. Although, well, sometimes it's a little more profane than mom. So he thinks that's hilarious.
So before we get started talking about your journey to becoming a self-defender, let's talk about your role at Active Self-Protection. First of all, you're not married to John Correa, so we can clear that up right away. As some people in the comments seem to think, you're not Mrs. Asp. We know Mrs. Asp, and she's not you. So what is it you do, in a nutshell, for and with Active Self-Protection?
What I do is I help run the company. John has a vision of what he wants the company to be doing and the message we want to be sending. And I work closely with him to facilitate that. How are we going to direct things and do things in order to send the message and do the work that we want to do? So kind of maybe he's the big picture dreamer and I'm probably the detail person.
Yeah, I'm glad he has you as a detail person because I'm definitely not a detail person. I don't know about Neil, but I'll tell you, folks at home who don't know Stephanie, haven't met her, she keeps this thing humming along. And when it comes to certain things like the National Conference, for example, along with some help from Shannon Millerbrook and other people, there are so many moving parts that it makes my head spin. And I get a little peek behind the scenes at what they deal with, and just the level of detail orientation is astounding and impressive. So, and we appreciate you. So now I know your story, or most of it, as it relates to you becoming a self-defender, but let's go back a little further than those incidents. And let's talk about your childhood, your growing up. Were you around guns as a kid? Were you around hunting, fishing, law enforcement, anything like that?
No, nothing really at all. I think I grew up kind of agnostic on guns, really. I don't remember my family being anti-gun, pro-gun. It just wasn't part of our life. I think I probably would have been okay with the idea of hunting or potentially even the idea of guns for self-defense, but it just wasn't part of my experience at all, good or bad.
So it never entered the consciousness of your family. Did you grow up in, I know you're in South Dakota now, did you grow up there?
In the Midwest, Iowa, South Dakota, a little bit in Colorado.
Okay,
so always kind of fairly midland towns.
Right, so that you were in places where guns were probably fairly common. They weren't unusual, so they were in your conscience, just not part of your life. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So, fast forward, you get married to the most handsome man alive, Neil Widener.
Yes, and very lucky.
And you guys are married. You have some kids, and you are fostering someone. And that's part of the story that led you to want to take agency over your own protection. So talk to us about that whole situation.
Sure. Yeah, I met Neil and he was not really in the self-defense world at all, but an avid outdoorsman, hunting, fishing, all of that, birds, deer. So guns were very much a part of his life. And then also growing up rural in the country, that was just, you know, there was a gun sitting in the corner to defend the sheep from coyotes, if that's what you needed to do, even as a little one. That so it was a very different experience growing up. And I became very comfortable with that. But then at one point he wanted to get a handgun for the house, and I just couldn't get there. To me, that was a tool that was designed to kill people. And I had heard and believed that that was a bigger risk to my family and kids than it would be a benefit. And so I asked him to get rid of it, and he's an incredible husband and wanted a happy wife. And that's what he did. So we continued to have the shotguns, the rifles, the hunting stuff, but that really, other than it being in my house, was not something I had much to do with. Then we did decide to be a foster parent. I had four daughters at that point, biological daughters, 10 and under. And we decided we wanted to be foster parents, and went through that process, got a call that they had a long-term foster placement, and it was a bit contentious. There was a pretty dysfunctional and extended enmeshed family that had been involved in social services for generations. And we happened to live, we were new parents, and we were in a very rural place, and it was very difficult to find, even if you knew our address. So they chose us. They also suggested we not get involved with the biological family. Normally they want you kind of mentoring them now. But they just said, of course, you have the right to be involved in all this stuff, but you're going to be happier if you're not involved with the family. They're pretty irate that the baby's been taken. So we went through that, and we agreed to all that. And the social worker would come get the baby and take him for visitation, bring him home. And we didn't have any issues from there for quite a while. We did come up with a plan, because this was a big extended family that lived in the same town that I lived in and ostensibly would recognize this child, and I wouldn't recognize them. We came up with a plan that if someone were to approach us in public, they actually did love this baby. They were not able to care for him, but they loved him very much.
And I understand that distinction, yeah.
Yes. So I thought the best thing to do, and what Neil and I agreed on, was I would let them take the baby rather than get into this huge fight downtown, potentially hurt the baby or our other kids. And so that was our plan. Then fast forward a couple of months, and I got a call on my house phone from our social worker, who said that she had gotten a call from the parents, and the parents were an extended relative had gotten out of prison and was very frustrated that one of their family members had been taken. This was an affront to the family, and he was going to take the parents and another adult and come get this baby back. The parents weren't really on board with this, but they were really overwhelmed by the rest of the family. So they called, gave a heads up to the social worker, who gave a heads up to me. Part of me still wasn't super worried, because our house was still really hard to find. It turns out they had not redacted our address on the last forms they sent to the family. They had done that up to this point, and I know this will shock you that the government forgot to redact them on one form. Not shocked at all.
This is my shocked face.
As our favorite former Fed, you're well aware of governmental incompetence. I still wasn't crazy worried yet, because even if you put our address into MapQuest at the time, it took you to the wrong place. So I still felt like we were okay. We were at the end of a dirt road in a very secluded area. However, I started making plans, and I sent all my kids downstairs and told them to hide under the stairs, keep the baby with them, and whatever else happened, they stayed there. And I don't care what else they hear, don't come out. I called the police and let them know. Unfortunately, that call routed to the next county over, so they didn't get to my house until about 25 minutes after the event happened. So that was not super helpful. In this process, I also grabbed another cell phone and called my husband, who worked a couple of miles away. And he started heading towards the house. As I was on the phone with him, I looked up and I saw the car that had been described to me, a silver van, coming down the road. And this is a dead end dirt road. There's no other houses there. This was them. And I stopped for a minute. And I talked to Neil and I said, I know we had this plan, and the plan was to let them take the baby, but they take this baby today over my dead body. And there was this pause, and my husband, who actually does love me very much, but he said, yes, that's what we're doing. Do what you need to do. And so I got off the phone with him, and then I stood there and I thought, now I have this group of adults coming to my house. I have five kids, 10 and under, and I'm the only thing standing between them and this very credible threat. And I was willing to die for my kids. We all are. That's not even a special thing. That doesn't make me this outstanding parent.
Some of us are. But You know what I mean? But you know those parents who maybe not so great. But anyway, moving on.
That's totally fair. Totally fair. But I would say for the most part, it's not that I was unique in that way. I was willing to do it, but it really hit me in this very real moment that didn't solve my problems at all. If they decided to kill me on the doorstep to get to my children, then I was gone. The only thing standing between them was gone. It was removed and I was not any help after that. And that really, it wasn't, you know, like the switch where now I need to go get a gun and learn about self-defense, but it was this very helpless moment where I wanted to be able to defend my kids with everything in me. I'm one of those that has that switch and wants to fight. I had a great attitude. I came up with a reasonable plan, not the best one now that I'm a little more knowledgeable, but I had no skills to defend the most precious things in my life. And I needed to change that.
Yeah, that's not a good feeling. I can't relate to it, but I can certainly imagine what that feels like. And so at that point, the family arrives, and they I think the people at home are dying to know exactly what happened at that point. So
I always forget to close it because it's a very anticlimactic. To me, that's the end of the story. It's very anticlimactic. They pulled into the driveway, and they sat there for about a minute, the longest minute of my life, like a literal 60 seconds, and then they backed out and left. So they must have, they changed their mind for some reason, and that was the end of it. The police showed up 25 minutes later. My husband passed them on the way home, actually, and I had called the police, and I said, they're going this way, and they're wearing this vehicle, and they were like, okay, whatever. I'm like, I am literally reporting an attempted kidnapping.
Yeah, I mean,
Communication was just not great.
Yeah, you know? That's frequently a problem. John and I talk about that during some of these badge cam videos, and I know that from the police end of things, where they're getting told something that's being funneled through the consciousness of a dispatcher, and then she or he is typing that into a computer to talk to another dispatcher who's talking to the cops. So it's like the most dangerous game of telephone ever.
And this is the worst, like where our house was on a line of two different counties, two different cities. I mean, like the corner of our block there was just this confluence of all these different territories. After this, I was able to talk to the chief of police of that town, went to church with us. And he was like, here is my cell phone, because this is going to continue to happen to you. If there's an emergency, you call me. So that's fantastic. But he still wouldn't have gotten there in time. They were there before anybody else was.
So folks listening, at home or in your car or wherever you are, do yourself a favor. Google the local law enforcement agency that you think services your house, especially if you're rural. Call the non-emergency number and say, hey, if I call 911, where does it go? They will know. The dispatcher will know that. And they don't mind you calling to ask this question, because you don't want to find out when there's a group of angry people in a van the hard way. You don't want to find out the hard way that your call isn't going where you thought it was going. It's going to the next town over, and you're on your own as far as police services go. And, you know, the cops do their best. They can't be everywhere at once, and they are only as good as their equipment and the telecommunication system they're using and the dispatchers who are funneling the information. So what you knew was a credible threat right now, this minute, to them was, oh, there's people in a van near your house. Like that doesn't translate. That urgency doesn't always translate to the officer or the deputy listening in. So after this went down, I'm sure you and Neil had a conversation that day. Mm-hmm. Walk us through your journey from having kind of a slapdash last minute plan to actually becoming trained, purchasing a firearm, all that sort of thing. Because don't forget, folks, she did not want a handgun in the house.
I did not. In fact, I made him sell the one that he bought, and he did. So we had nothing. And in theory, I had those other guns there, but I didn't know how to use the rifles or shotguns other than if somebody handed it to me and said, pull this trigger. So I think I kind of just started Googling and reading and trying to understand what I could do and how I could learn. And I honestly, to this day, don't remember how I stumbled across this. It was obviously a pivotal thing. I wish I did remember. But the idea that I could get a concealed carry permit in my state. And I thought, I can literally carry a gun. Like, I can do that. Okay. So I started just learning about that process. Now, I still had 5 kids under the age of 10. My foster child that I was trying to protect had been adopted at this point, and he is the Cody to whom we were referring to earlier.
The Cody.
the Cody. If you come to the conference, you're very well acquainted. Or if you ever call me, you're likely very well acquainted with Cody. So he is a joy. But I had to learn how to protect him. So I just started reading like crazy. I see so many first-time gun owners and women that show up in classes. I was not that courageous at that moment. I found an online course in Iowa, you could do an online course to get your permit. So I went through that whole process. I did go to the gun store. I chose my own gun, which was a 22 pistol intended. It was like a carry pistol, not a target pistol, which in some ways is absolutely not a great choice. And in some ways it was fantastic. I loved that gun. I sat and I read the manual and I learned how to run it. I owned it, and you could buy, you can find 22 anywhere for nothing. So I shot it like crazy and just started learning. I ended up online following Active Self-Protection, the company that I help run now. And I was just watching and learning everything. I remember watching those videos and seeing, like a convenience store and somebody going in, stopping on their way home after work to pick up a gallon of milk or something. And then in me knowing in 3 to 5 seconds, everything is going to change in this video. But right now in this moment, it's as normal as it could be. And that was not what I imagined violence looking like. And I realized that I needed to learn so much more in order to effectively defend myself. And I just fell in love with the whole idea of protecting those that you love and life and things that are valuable. So I started taking classes. I became an instructor in my own right. I started volunteering at Active Self-Protection years ago, long before there was a YouTube channel, and just grew with it. And it's been an incredible journey.
And I think if you think about it, it's kind of a natural progression. Mama bear syndrome is a real thing. When, when the kids are threatened, when the home is threatened, she wants to be able to protect them. And you went from a place where you had that desire in spades, but couldn't necessarily do anything about it physically. Mm-hmm. And right. I think your story is phenomenal. And there's so many other women just like you, as you know, out there who went from unconscious incompetence, not knowing what they didn't know, to educating themselves, to being able to protect. I feel fully confident that if Neil were off at work and it was just you and the kids at home, you would be fully capable of protecting them if the wolf came to the door. So
absolutely. And the progression that's even that I love even more than that is I have now been able to pass that on to many of my own daughters, who would now be able to defend my home and themselves more, is as effectively as me, which is like my greatest joy. All these women that you've had on these different episodes talking about how they've been able to make a difference in not only their own lives and their own families, but in these like huge pools of students and other people looking to do exactly what I did. I can be willing to die to defend my family, but it doesn't do any good. What does do good?
And now you have the tools. You might say you have the attitude, skills, and plan to defend your family.
You might say exactly that.
There's another episode, folks, if you look back a little bit, called No One Is Coming to Save You. I might call this one No One's Coming to Save You Part 2. I haven't figured that out yet.
Creative.
But we talked to Lisa Ludwig and Carrie Dudenhofer and Wendy Hoffman, and there's a through line to all these stories, and that through line is woman has something to protect, event happens, and then she decides to take agency over her home protection. Mm-hmm. And I hope we can do more shows like this. Mm. I don't want to be, totally female centric, but I think it's an underserved part of the self-defense community, getting good, sane, sober, moral, prudent people together to have women not need their husband or the police or whomever in that moment, because they're not always going to be there. So no. Stephanie, I'm super proud of you. You're a lot of fun to work for, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Mike. This was a lot of fun. Anytime.
And joining us on the show is Robin Sandoval. Robin is the executive director of A Girl and a Gun, and one of my new friends. We had the chance to meet at the Active Self-Protection National Conference and hit it off. Robin, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Mike, for having me on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure. What part of the country are you in?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Oh, lovely. Have they done anything about the homeless problem in Austin, Texas yet, or is it still bad?
It's much, much better. They put it to a statewide vote, and when everyone voted against the camping ban, finally they sent in the state troopers. So once it was no longer an Austin problem, the governor was able to kind of escalate things, and it's starting to get cleared up finally.
Nice. I was in Austin in, I can't remember, 06, 07, something like that, for South by Southwest. I was played piano in a band that was there and had a blast. It was a lovely place. I know it is the Berkeley of Texas, but it's still a beautiful place, and I would recommend visiting. So are you married? Do you have any kids?
Yes, I'm married, and I have 3 kids, 2 boys and a girl.
Outstanding. We did 2 and 2. My wife did. Like Chuck Wilber used to say, 2 boys, 2 girls. I married into 2 girls, but, you know, I'm dad. So tell me, did you grow up around guns? Were you a gun person your whole life, or tell us about that?
Well, I was actually strongly anti-gun for most of my life. It wasn't until I was a mom that I even entertained the idea. And what happened was I was watching the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I was sitting on my couch in safety, but I watched a modern American city become debilitated overnight. And there was a moment I saw a mother at the Superdome hand her small children to strangers who were getting on a bus to Houston. And she said, "Please take them. I'll try to find you in a few days." And my heart broke for her. And I turned to my husband and I said, "What do I have to do that's never me? That no matter what happens, we can stay together as a family, that we can hunker down." And I said, "I'm going to start storing peanut butter and tuna fish so that if a hurricane was to hit Austin, Texas, we would be safe and we could ride it out for a couple weeks." And he said, "If people are that desperate that they're willing to do the unthinkable, someone's going to kick in our door for our peanut butter and tuna fish. How am I going to stop them?" And after arguing for gun control my entire life, I had no argument. It came down to these 3 little people that were mine, and I had to do what it took to protect them.
Yeah, I won't say it's funny, but it's interesting you should say that. That's something that Lisa Ludwig, she lives in Long Island, New York, and they had a crime issue that was getting worse and worse. And she said something very similar. She said, "You know, all the stuff I've worked so hard for, somebody could just come in a moment and take it all away from me, or take my life, even worse." So that's very interesting. So at that point, you realize, hey, I need to be able to protect my own, and I can't do it with my bare hands. So I need a tool to do that with. So walk us through initially when you decided, okay, we need to buy a gun. Did you buy a gun first? Did you get training first? Or just kind of walk us through that.
Well, I agreed to have a firearm in our home that I would never touch. It would stay in the safe. I would never have anything to do with it unless it was a complete catastrophe and we had to resort to it. But I was afraid of it. So we did purchase our first firearm and it was in the safe. And I thought it was going to come out of the safe on its own and injure us. You know, I thought it would sprout legs on its own. So my husband really encouraged me to get training so that I wouldn't be afraid of it. And at the time, there was an instructor here locally named Juliana Crowder who was trying to get more women to the range. And she had this idea of having girls' night out at the range. And so she started a little club called The Girl and the Gun. And I went to their 3rd girls' night out. Actually, I didn't even sign up to go. My husband RSVP'd for me to go on Meetup. He's like, "I signed you up. You're going. They're expecting you." And I don't know if I was more scared of shooting the gun or meeting other women or going to a gun range. Just all of it was completely outside my comfort zone, but I went. And that night changed my life forever. I met really great women who were able to answer all my questions about shooting. I became more confident with shooting over time. And, you know, as it goes over time, I began competing and mentoring others and became an instructor. And Julian and I partnered, and now we host over 260 ranges across the country offer our Girls Night Out program.
That's so good. And I love the fact that your husband didn't take you to the range or try to show you and try to pick a gun for you. So you picked a good one, because the fact that he reached out for that kind of resource and just said, "Hey, you're going," and didn't try to run the show is really, really cool. It's kind of unusual, actually. You said you went to the range, had a great time with these ladies, and then you moved on. I want to go a little bit more in depth about after that. Can I ask what the first gun is you guys bought for home defense?
My first gun is a Glock 23, 40 cal, and her name is Francesca, and she's hot pink now.
Francesca, I like it. So after that, is that the gun you ran for a while when you went to the range, or did you buy something else?
Yeah, no, I love that gun. And even when I would try different guns, I would always kind of fall back to my Glock 23. I just really liked the feel of it and became increasingly more confident with it. So I wanted to be my go-to because I knew I could efficiently run that gun.
Yeah. And you talk about women's empowerment. You want to empower a woman, empower her to defend herself on her own when no one is there to protect her and she has to handle business or protect her children. This is what real women's empowerment looks like in my view. Talk to us about a girl and a gun. If someone in, Toledo, Ohio, or you know, upstate New York wants to get a hold of this, how do they do that? Because I don't know exactly how someone finds a chapter. So talk to us about that for a second.
Our website, agirlandagun.org, has a list of all of our chapters. We have chapters across the country. So ladies are hosting recurring events mostly called Girls Night Out. So we have different kinds of events, but Girls Night Out is kind of the heartbeat of our organization. And there it ranges all across the country. So if there's a Girls Night Out near you, you can just show up. The great thing is that you'll meet other women, and it will really open opportunities for you for training. So whether it's private lessons or classes that the range has coming up, or classes that the instructor has coming up, or events that a girl and a gun has coming up, we really layer on those local opportunities with virtual events, with regional events, and national events.
Very cool. Have you experienced, it's maybe not because you had this initial experience with a girl and a gun, so you had a really good nurturing environment that was caring and took their time and explained things to you and didn't condescend. But since then, you've been to a million events. Have you experienced any of that sort of, not misogynist, but just generally sort of a you know, condescending, pat you on the head attitude from any of your male counterparts?
I don't think you get very far in this industry without running into a lot of those kinds of guys. Yes. Over the years, you know, I've been doing this almost 11 years now, so I can pretty much handle and manage any conversation. But there are definitely that good old boy network, those guys that still want to condescend and still want to tell me about my own business. They'll mansplain to me about how it is to run a women's organization. Absolutely. I think most of the time, though, when I let them know that my merit stands on its own, I just ask them to Google me, and then we'll have another conversation about it later.
That's great. Yeah, just Google me. I was talking to, I think I was talking to Carrie Dudenhofer about this recently, but I think a lot of, there's two camps when it comes to that kind of guy at the gun store, that kind of guy at the range. And I think, and I don't know like if it's 50-50 or 60-40, but I think a lot of those guys mean well. You know, they want to help. They want to give good information. The problem is they're giving terrible information, and they're, whether they know it or not, they're being insulting. But I think when a husband tells his wife, or a boyfriend tells his girlfriend, or the guy at the gun store tells a woman who's at the counter, you need to get and fill in the name of the completely inappropriate gun here, like a 5-shot 22 revolver or something useless. I think they mean well, but I hope, I really hope that by doing more shows like this, that we can kind of get the word out to people that, you know, if you want to help a female, one of the best things you can do is probably direct her towards a girl and a gun. If not, do your research and find a good, if you can, good, competent female instructor in your area to take her to, because the reason that men and women gravitate towards self-defense and firearms ownership are frequently very different. You want to talk about that for a second?
Fortunately, a lot of gun stores and even big retail chains have reached out to us, and I've done a lot of seminars with their gun counters on how to kind of coach them on the questions to ask women consumers. So a lot of them, like you said, really want to help, and most of the time it's really well-intentioned, but they kind of get stuck in what they think is the right path instead of asking those important questions like, what is this gun going to be used for? What are your goals for it? What is your experience? And, you know, back in the day, my, like I said, my Glock 23, it's hot pink, and I call it Francesca. And there will be all kinds of guys at the range. I remember as a new shooter, even though I had by then put in a lot of rounds downrange, but still relatively new compared to now. And these men would, you know, scoff at the fact that I had a pink gun, or I'd hear all the different comments about making guns fun colors, or, you know, any of those statements, lots of judgment thrown this way until they saw my target. And then they would come and say, how'd you do that? Can you teach me how to do that? Can I shoot your pink gun? Maybe it's the gun that's making that happen. So that was always kind of a fun thing that I actually enjoyed. I love changing the paradigm of what women gun owners are. I love letting these men know that shooting can be fun.
Absolutely. No, boys, it's not the gun. It's the person running the gun that's making the target quite that tight. My work wife, when I was a special agent, was a good friend of mine, and she used to carry these pink handcuffs. And there was nothing funnier than slapping these pink handcuffs on some big, burly, prison-fit, parolee-looking guy, you know? Good times. I think you're doing the Lord's work, and I appreciate you being on the show. Do you want to tell the folks how they can contact you for training opportunities or appearances, or how to get a hold of a Girl and a Gun chapter in their area?
Visit agirlandagun.org. You'll see a list of all of our chapters. You'll see our upcoming events and all of our social media channels, too. They all kind of direct the road back to me, so I would love to meet any of your listeners.
All right, ladies and men who know ladies who they think want to get into firearms, you know what to do. Go check it out. And Robin, thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And with us on the line now is my friend, Shelly Hill. Shelly, do you go by all three names? I know, like, the Facebook name has your maiden name, I assume. Do you go by just Shelly Hill?
I do. I go by Shelley Hill. Yep.
All right. And you're married to some guy, some instructor guy. I can't remember.
You know, some dude picked me up at the roller skating rink when I was about 14, and I don't know. We're still together.
I mean, I guess I've heard of him. He's somebody, I guess, in the industry. I don't know. Brian Hill.
His name's Brian Hill. He's a pretty cool dude.
And now, while Shelley's achievements and outstanding work ethics stand on their own without Brian in the picture, if you don't know who Brian Hill is, get out from under your rock. Go look at YouTube on the Extra Channel. He's one of the best instructors out there today, and I had the pleasure of interacted with him at the national conference, and you guys are two of my favorite people. So Shelley is the co-owner and executive officer and an instructor at the Complete Combatant. She is the designer and mastermind behind the image-based decisional drills, which is, if you don't know what that is, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a little bit. Smart Choices imaging cards, and both of the Complete Combatant's annual events called the Mingle, which is for ladies in the firearms community, which is kind of what this show is about. And the Quest, which is a thing for red dot shooters only. And she presents and teaches at a bunch of national conferences. Shelley, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. How about yourself?
I can't complain. I'm living the retired dream and getting to sit in my wife's closet. I mean, the Active Self-Protection Studios. And talk to awesome people. So things couldn't be much better. Talk to us about growing up as a kid. I know you live in Georgia now. You're married, kids?
Absolutely. Married. Have one little girl, two grandkids, and moved to Georgia from Illinois when we were roughly 11.
And did you grow up in a household that had firearms in them, or was that an adult onset thing for you dealing with guns?
Well, I found out later that we did live in a household with firearms in it, but we didn't know it as children. There wasn't a discussion or, you know, anything like that, that nowadays is a little bit more common. But no, I had no idea that there was a firearm in our house growing up.
So you're obviously very, very involved in the firearm self-defense community. Can you talk to us about when that started for you? Because every time I talk to someone, male or female, especially with females, especially there's an event of some kind, there's something that happened or a wake-up call of some sort. What did that look like for you?
That's kind of interesting because my wake-up call, I didn't realize, Mike, that my wake-up call was actually when I was about 27 and I'm 50 now. But I didn't realize it until I told this story roughly a year ago. So it's interesting how your mind buries this. I was in Atlanta. I was 27 years old. I was in my car, and I was at a stoplight. And I was the first person, underneath the stoplight. And I was driving a Chevelle. And the window was rolled down about, 4 or 5 inches. And I was just minding my own business. And it was literally the cliche, came out of nowhere. I had no idea it was happening. All that kind of good stuff. Next thing I know is there is a man that has both hands on my window and is starting to shake my window and trying to open the door. And the door happened to be locked. Mike, I froze. It never occurred to me to go forward in the vehicle. It never occurred to me to carry pepper spray or something, more lethal. It never occurred to me to use my voice. It never occurred to me to move to the other side of the vehicle. I literally sat there. And in a truck behind me, it was a big truck, and this dude got out and started flapping his arms and so on and so forth and moving towards us and this guy. He ran away. So that was the end of it. And I remember thinking to myself, once the adrenaline rush came down to where I could think, I will never freeze again. That was the drama. And I have it. I do. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, I started my journey then to not freeze again.
Yeah, I think this is a recurring theme. I think a lot of people, men and women, don't think about if this, then what? They don't think about if this happens, what am I going to do? It doesn't enter their mind. I think a lot of folks would rather live their lives with the strategy of hope that nothing will happen to me, that a bad guy won't come into my orbit, won't penetrate my sphere and do bad things to me. And so, this is not uncommon. The other ladies I've talked to, it was an ex-boyfriend who was stalking them, or in Steph's case, it was pretty unique, but, someone tried to come kidnap one of her kids back, foster parents. So that event is critical. So how long after that and you made that decision, that moment, that never be, to never freeze again. How long after that did you sort of get proactive into looking into various modes of self-defense, firearms, things of that nature?
Immediately. I drove to a friend's house afterwards, and I know that he had shot before and that he carried at the time. It was a Glock. And I went, literally called him, knocked on his apartment door, and said, let's go. And the training began that day within 2 hours afterwards. And, you know, once again, you start with the pistol because that's what was available at the time. But it started immediately, Mike. I knew right then and there that I couldn't freeze again. That was the worst feeling in the entire world, was just not knowing what to do.
And again, recurring theme for sure.
Yeah.
You know, people don't have these conversations in their head ahead of time about what they might do. And John and I talk about this on the Badgecam videos, about if you haven't had a talk with yourself in your head about pulling the trigger against another human being. Now, having that conversation, of course, is no guarantee that you will do that when the time comes. But it's better to have talked to yourself about it ahead of time, and so that it's not a last minute decision. Can I really do this? And I think also, I can't stress enough how important some kind of force on force training is, so that you can actually go up against another human being and pull the trigger. I mean, for lack of a better way of explaining it. So you started right then and there. Talk to us about. Now, at the time this happened, were you married?
Nope, not at the time. I was by myself, and really just took this upon myself to go for it. Now, I knew Brian, of course. He was in the picture because we had known each other since I was 14, and he was 17, and he was my next phone call.
Very good.
So, yep, and then I headed back to the range with him and testing a couple different firearms and see what worked for me. But I still made the wrong decision. Started with a 357 snub nose, what was it, revolver, hammerless. That was not the best choice, but it was pretty.
Yeah, and I mean, at least, you know, this is another recurring theme on this show is people, sometimes women, sometimes men, but people deciding they want to, quote unquote, get a gun. Yep. And they haven't thought through, am I going to carry it? Is it for home defense? And frequently they will go out, and we're trying to keep people from doing this, making the same mistake in the future. They go out and they go to a gun store and they go, what should I get? And I think it was Lisa Ludwig who said, you wouldn't walk into a Honda dealership and go, what Honda should I get? You know, you have an idea already of what kind of vehicle you want, an SUV, or you want a pickup, or you want a sedan. And so we're trying to stress the idea that it's really important to get with someone who knows what they're doing and get some training and then buy a firearm. Yeah, meaning that you don't know what's going to work for you. Men and women are built differently. People have different strength in their hands and their arms to action the slide or whatever the case may be. So after the 357, what was your next firearm?
The next one I ended up with what was it? Walther PPK.
Okay.
And that one kept biting me. And once again, Brian just let me do my thing, right? And the whole time he's, quiet and probably shaking his head. But, he let me explore and do my thing. And, I ended up going through several other firearms, Smith & Wesson. Loved my Shield. Too small, And then as I progressed and got to be a better shooter, so did my firearms. So did my sights, right? All this stuff kind of came together that as you grow, as maybe some of your goals grow, then you may go through a couple different firearms. You may not just end up with the first one you buy. You may change, which is okay too.
We've been on some of these WebEx calls for the active self-protection instructor development course together, and you've heard people. We even have like Karen Whitlock, who owns a gun store, saying that people will come in and make terrible decisions. And, as the person at the gun shop, they can only say so much. But I guarantee she sees the husband come in with a wife, the boyfriend come with a girlfriend, and tell them, oh, sweetheart, you just need a .22 revolver or whatever. Some terrible decision, and they have to bite their tongue. You have a kind of unique experience in that you knew Brian. He was able to kind of be with you in this journey and prevent you from making terrible decisions anyway, because I'm sure he wasn't condescending and didn't pat you on the head either.
No.
At some point, you went from taking agency over your own self-protection to helping other people do that for themselves. So what did that look like for you? How long was it before you decided, I want to help other people on this journey?
2011 is when I started really getting involved, you know, NRA, kind of seeing what's going on there, became GeorgiaCarry.org member that really works here in Georgia for rules, regulations, and laws, concealed carry permit 2011. And that's when I started training myself, right? Mm-hmm. You start thinking about, what am I learning? What is beneficial to me? And could I actually be the right person for somebody who is looking for some answers? Could I be that, possibly be that person to help them? Could I be the one that may help somebody? And it just kept going from there. So I don't remember honestly exactly when I got my first certificate in training, as far as, you know, chief range safety officer or NRA or refuse to be a victim. All of that came first. And that would have been, I mean, obviously several years ago, but kind of the mindset part of it came first. And then, of course, your basic for instructor certifications came in. And just, you know, you just keep growing from there. If it's something you feel like you can make a difference and that you might be able to reach someone, and all those wonderful things, hopefully doing it for all the right reasons. And now I'm at a place where I'm just honestly honored when someone asks for help or guidance through either the complete combatant or image-based decisional drills or smart choices, because we've just taken it a little bit step further from that of the range.
Again, I'm all about these recurring themes, but yeah, I think it was Lisa Ludwig. I was talking to her in the previous episode about, you know, when it occurred to her, she might be the person, you know, you know, in an emergency, everybody says, oh, someone do something. Well, who's someone, you know, who is the someone? And it was her in her case, you know, she's, you know what, I maybe I can do this. Maybe I can step out of my comfort zone a little bit. Because all these ladies from her neighborhood in Long Island were like, well, you know, we need to do something. The crime is spiking. Lisa told a story about there being like a doorbell video in her neighborhood of a woman being chased into her home by a man, a crazy deranged man with a 9mm. Mm. And she made it inside and locked the door. And the guy's trying to mule kick the door open, and something scared him away at some point. And all the people she showed this to were like, holy mackerel, we got to do something. And Lisa was that someone, just like you're that someone. Now, can you talk to us? I think people might not have any idea what image-based decisional drill means. So could you just talk to us about that for a moment?
Absolutely. I'm dyslexic, which is a little bit on the interesting side, because let me tell you a little bit about my personality. Is I've always done things in my life that I'm going to call it helping people, not necessarily self-defender or whatever, you know, self-defense, but helping people. Started a nonprofit organization called Rachel's Rest, and that was, almost 9 years ago for sexually abused women and children of acts of violence. I worked the OR and helping people on the medical side. And that was 34 years and just retired this year in February, and now the complete combatant. So my brain works that way. I'm able to make decisions somehow, you know, fairly quickly. And it's because I think of my training and my background. So I'm dyslexic. So in 2019, me and Claude and Brian, that's Claude Werner, the tactical professor, we're talking about the way people learn. And I had just said that I have a heck of a time sometimes going to these classes and, you know, paperwork. And I don't know that my learning, is as strong as maybe some other people in that type of setting. So we started talking about the way that I learn. Well, I learn through images and hands-on. Mm. And as we start getting a little bit further into that, that really, truly, the quickest way to learn something, retention, long-term memory, all these wonderful things, decrease learning time, improve comprehension, once again, enhance retrieval, and then increase retention. Believe it or not, it's images. It is absolutely scientifically proven that visual cues help us better retrieve information and remember it.
It's so funny you say that, because that, you know, my brain, I think we have similar brain makeup, for lack of a better way of putting it. My brain goes 1,000 miles an hour all the time. And so when I'm doing this show, I have to remind myself that people will have to put this on half speed to even hear what I'm saying because I'm talking so quickly. But I completely understand what you mean when you say that, because I thank God for YouTube tutorials, you know, stuff like that, because I'm you know, trying to read a book for me. I'm not dyslexic. I'm mathematically dyslexic, I think. Math is hard for me, but trying to get through a book, like for this class, there's a lot of reading material and it's just a laborious chore for me every time to sit down and read a book. And I think there's a stigma about that. Oh, well, you know, you don't read books. You're obviously stupid. You're dumb.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
no.
And that's not true at all. I think you and I are reasonably intelligent people, and I would much rather have you show me a thing than try to read about it. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure what in the brain causes that to be the case. But
It's not uncommon. When we think about it, our brain is actually an image processor. We're not necessarily a word processor. We're image processor. Words are fairly new. If you think about images are forever. So our brain is actually geared towards the sensory cortex. It's actually devoted to vision. So that means that a lot of people are just like us, Mike, and they may not know it. You know, they haven't given themselves either a chance, or they don't know. Another one is their children. Right. There's four main ways to children learn, and hands on. That's why all the children's books have lots of images and colors and stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. Because they can learn quicker. Well, the same goes for the adults. You know, there's not much different except for, you know, we've just kind of done the same thing over and over, and we need to look outside the box a little bit. And some people are like me and you that just immediately get it. And some people, they have to experience it. But, you know, and it's not everyone, but it is so the percentage-wise of people learn when images are connected to content of all those positive things, that's where the image-based decisional drills actually came from. And it's the ability to make a decision very, very quickly. And then be able to act on it. So this learning system, you can evaluate your strengths and weaknesses of your decision. You can do it on the range, or you can do it in dry practice. Did you make one good first decision? You know, it's all about visual cueing and pre-need. What else? Verbal commands, distant management. If I could get on my high horse and we had 6 hours that you would let me talk about proxemics, and that's the distance management on making decisions based on how far someone is away from you in a social setting or so on and so forth. I think that is something that's very important that we touch base on, of course, in image-based decisional drills as well.
Yeah, interesting you should say that. The episode we had Soleil Rocher on, she had to defend her and her children from a very aggressive person who was charging at them. And that the proxemics came into it because he was half a block away yelling and muttering and screaming, at which point there's no need to do much of anything. But she was paying attention. Had she not been paying attention to where he was and where he was moving towards and when he picked up the pace, she might not have been as prepared as she was.
So many people don't think that there's so many other decisions. Let's say they make one first good decision, which is what we would teach in image-based decisional drills. And that could be the instructor certification course, or that could be the class, or it could be the kit, you know, that you would buy online. That what we're looking for is one good first decision. And that comes through recognition prime decision making. Once you get through that, the chances of you making another good decision, which means maybe remove yourself from that area and then make another good decision, which means it might be the 911 call. And then another good decision would be, let's give our location first so they know it's where we're at. So this is called cognitive stacking. And that's where Soleil did such a great job. Is her first good decision was she didn't have her head in her phone, right? She was more aware, especially changes in the environment. That's a word we like to use. She recognized the change in the environment, which was somebody who didn't belong and was doing something that shouldn't be done. They didn't have a right to do that.
Right.
So that brought her attention to them. So that's her first really good decision, is knowing and recognizing, ooh, this could happen. This may happen. This is happening.
Right.
Right? There was no denial in it. It was, okay, I recognize it. I see it. I'm prepared for it. I've trained. I understand the distant management. I know that I can ignore him and I can leave this setting right now because he's X amount away. And as he got closer, well, that's where decisions need to be made even quicker. And she was able to do that. So, and then once again, that was the cognitive stacking of good decisions. So she's the perfect example of what just making a plan ahead and taking that few minutes and go, I can do it. And this is the distance of my inert pepper spray, mm-hmm. right? So I know how far it goes. And I told my kids, this is what I need for you to do when mommy says this. She just executed it beautifully. It's beautiful.
That's the plan part of attitude, skills, and plan is having all these things taken care of ahead of time, because you're not going to rise to the occasion all of a sudden, right. you know, in the moment. And I really like something that Stephanie Widener was talking about during one of her classes at the National Conference. And that is, especially for women, because yeah. your margin for error or victory as a woman is a lot smaller than it is for a bigger, yeah. stronger male person. So yeah. she said you have to radically accept reality. When something bad is yes. happening, you need to immediately realize this is happening. I can't wish it away. I have to do yes. something. Even if that something is run away, which is almost always preferable. So I added rapidly to that equation. So radically and rapidly, so quickly make a decision. This is going badly. I need to remove myself from the situation, or I need to draw a gun or pepper spray, whatever the case may be. So right. really interesting how all this stuff works together.
It really does. And you so just don't even know it, but you just set me up so beautifully. The definition of success for our image-based decisional drills is to quickly make one good first decision based on visual stimuli and instantly act on it. Be confident, decisive, efficient, and explosive. And explosive is the word that we use. We got that from William April. And he used to talk about having to make you have to be explosive. When the decision is made, you've got to do it. And I think we're on the same line, rapidly. That is an excellent word as well. That you've got to make that decision and do it.
Sure. So, I'm going to stop you right there because I want you to leave some stuff on the table so people come and give you money for your outstanding training.
But I want to tell them everything.
I know. Unfortunately, awesome. if I don't stop now, this episode's going to be 3 hours long because I have two other guests. So tell the good people yes, listening sir. In their car or at home, where can they find you? Where can they reach out for your training? Where can they find the Complete Combatant and you? And if you want to plug Brian's stuff as well, where can they find him?
Absolutely. Well, you can just find us, at The Complete Combatant, and it's very simple. It's thecompletecombatant.com, and that's going to be all about our training. You're going to find a couple links there that go to two separate websites, because Image-Based Decisional Drills does have its own website, which that's simple too. It's image-based decisionaldrills.com. And then we've got Smart Choices. So hopefully you'll bring me back on that we'll be able to talk about that. And that's the Smart Choices imagecards.com. So there's three separate websites and, three separate goals for each website. So you can find me on any of them.
To start out, keep it simple for the people listening who may not be able to write anything down. Thecompletecombatant.com is a good, yep. good jump off point.
Yep, that's it. Everything else is just, separate websites regarding some of the things we talked about.
Perfect. Shelley, delight talking to you.
And, me too.
And thanks for coming on the show, and I hope we'll talk to you soon.
You got it. I loved it. Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Okay, gang, back with us again this week. My friend Stephen Gutowski. Stephen is the founder of TheReload.com and the host of the weekly Reload podcast. And I just found out you can see some of his stuff on his YouTube channel. What's the name of the YouTube channel?
The Reload.
Very good.
It's very creative.
Very clever.
It's original.
I like it. So check him out on YouTube. Go give him a sub. I just subscribed. I'm on there. You have to see my face. Don't let that dissuade you from subscribing. You don't have to watch those videos if you don't want to.
Beautiful face.
So this week we're going to discuss an article in The Reload by Jake Fogelman. This came out on October 28th. Is that today? No, this is the 29th. So we're recording this the 29th for next week. So the article is entitled Delaware Ghost Gun Ban Quickly Hit with Lawsuit. And there's a lot of intricacies to this story. I'm going to let Stephen explain to you about how there is a tie-in from the Second Amendment to the First Amendment. But I just really, really quick, I want to discuss this. We're terrible at branding. Pro 2A people are terrible at branding. Who allowed this term ghost gun to become the thing we call it, because that makes it sound very scary and mysterious, and it's neither of those things. It's just a gun like any other gun. We need to come up with a better term for that. I thought privately manufactured firearm, or PMF, something like that. But ghost gun, we're just letting them run with the ball with this scary-sounding thing that it just plainly isn't.
Yeah, well, that's I think people in the gun community find it funny, right? Because it comes from, like, it comes from a particularly uninformed California politician.
Hilarious press conference.
Ranting about them. But yeah, ghost gun is essentially just a gun that doesn't have a serial number. And we usually associate that with homemade guns, right? Because if you make your own gun at home up to this point, it is, you haven't been required to serialize it. Unless you're, you know, and get a license to manufacture it, unless you're intending to sell them. And so if you're just making them for your own personal use, there's no law that says you have to put a serial number on it or anything. The other thing that gets kind of confusing quickly in this and can be used to mislead people often is that ghost guns can also refer to any gun that doesn't have a serial number. So that means guns that have had their serial number scratched off, as you tend to see with criminal use of firearms.
Completely different thing, though.
Yes, it's a very different subject. And so the reason that people in the gun control community are unhappy with this, these types of guns, is because it makes it more difficult for the ATF to trace the lineage of a firearm if it doesn't have a serial number. Because if it has a serial number, then they can trace the gun back at least to the first point of sale from a licensed firearms dealer, because all new sales of firearms have to go through an FFL, a federal firearms licensee. And all of those sales have to be documented so you can go back and at least see where it was first sold. Now, usually guns used in crimes have circulated for a number of years before they actually are recovered at a crime scene. Usually, I believe the average in the most recent ATF report was over 8 years. So, you know, someone bought the gun 8 years prior. In some cases, it can be, decades. But they bought the gun a long time ago legally, and then at some point, it got moved into criminal circles where it was used in a crime. And so that's why this is controversial to begin with. That is the concern here, is that without a serial number, it makes it more difficult to track where a gun has gone, how it's changed hands, things like that. But of course, even with a gun with a serial number isn't going to be perfect in that regard, because if you're selling it privately, there's no background check required in most states. And then obviously, if you're selling it illegally to someone you know is going to be committing crimes with it, you're probably not keeping records of that sale, even if you're required to, under is perhaps a universal background check law. So obviously the system for tracing guns is not perfect anyway, but that's where the concern comes from.
And I can tell you from a law enforcement perspective, it's pretty infrequent that the gun trace does us a lot of good as far as solving a crime goes. Usually it's matching the ballistics, matching the bullet to the barrel, that sort of thing. And, you know, if we're in possession of the weapon that was used in the crime, the serial number is not nearly as important as you might think from watching TV and movies where it's this critical thing. If it's a felon in possession or a prohibited possessor, sometimes we do want to find out where they got it from. Somebody with a DVB for something like that. So talk to us about this ban Delaware imposed, and then talk to us about the lawsuit that's seeking to block that ban.
Yeah, so Delaware has actually now passed a law that's really on the sort of cutting edge of this whole thing. They're really pushing the boundaries with this law, because they're not just outlawing making of your own personal firearms at home without serial numbers included. They are doing that, and they're making possession of those kinds of guns illegal, a felony, in fact, which is itself pushing the boundaries of what has been instituted to this point. So far, even though, that's even stricter than what California has done, where California requires that people serialize their own homemade firearms and register them with the state, Delaware is basically making it outright illegal to make your own firearms or even possess unfinished receivers, right? So at 80% lower, right? The popular sort of term for an unfinished receiver out there are, you know, those would be illegal in Delaware to possess or sell or anything like that. So that's already pushing the boundaries right in and of itself. But they've gone a step further and made it a felony to share files that include instructions on how to make firearms with a 3D printed gun. So really 3D blueprints of firearms, or really any kind of blueprint of a firearm that could be used as an instruction to create a firearm on a 3D printer.
Nice reach, Delaware. Wow. That's unbelievable. I don't think I'd heard that aspect of the story until I talked to you, because, you know, you think the government, you know, in quotes, would learn at some point that the more you try to suppress and ban something and prevent people from communicating, the more they're going to want to communicate in that way and share those files and do those things. So the lawsuit is from the Firearms Policy Coalition, and it's filed against the governor, John Carney. And they're saying this ban doesn't just violate the Second Amendment, but also the First. And we were talking about, for example, talking about the sharing of instructions and files relating to the manufacture of these privately manufactured firearms.
Right. So that's the area where this is even broader than any other ghost gun ban that's come into existence yet, because they're saying that you cannot even share a CAD file of a 1911 or an AR-15 lower or whatever the case may be, even on the internet, or I suppose even in public, if you handed out, a file, the memory card that had CAD files on it of gun designs, that would be a felony too. So it's really pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable under the First Amendment in terms of government speech restrictions, because this kind of restriction has been ruled unconstitutional in the past, not specifically to do with firearms necessarily, but there have been a number of rulings that indicate that code is speech in and of itself. You can't just ban, electronic files because you don't like their contents,
right?
Which is exactly what this is, right? I mean, we've had the H-bomb designs shared publicly, published by a magazine several decades back, where that the government tried to suppress that as well. And the Supreme Court sided with the publishers, the magazine that published it in place. So you can publish H-bomb designs, nuclear weapon designs, the plans for how to build a nuclear weapon. But according to Delaware, you cannot publish the designs for a 100-year-old gun like the 1911 without it being a felony. So you could see how this is going to be challenged in court, certainly. And I mean, it already has been now with FPC filing their case, but it's hard for me to imagine how Delaware is going to be able to justify all this.
A couple things I think are worth noting. One is that we should come up with popularize a different term for these guns, because as long as we let the anti-gun crowd sort of frame the argument and name the things, in this example, the ghost gun versus some more reasonable sounding name for it. And the minute you allow the government to tell you what you can and can't say about anything, whether it's guns or whether it's your religious beliefs or whatever it might be, you just can't let them encroach any more than they already have in those arenas. And they're trying desperately to. And I would like to think that anyone, whether they're pro or anti-gun, would care enough about the First Amendment to see plainly what this is and what it's about. Folks, if you are lamenting the lack of down-the-middle, sane, and sober reporting on the Second Amendment, please go over to thereload.com. Give Stephen a couple of bucks. What's the cheapest subscription you can get over there?
Well, we actually just had a flash sale that was super successful, but we're back to normal prices now. $10 a month, but if you sign up for a year, you get 2 months for free, so it's $100 a year. But you're going to get reporting that you literally can't get anywhere else, and you'll get access to exclusive posts, exclusive stories, exclusive analysis pieces, an exclusive newsletter on Sundays, exclusive early access to the podcast as well that you were just a guest on. You get a lot, and you help support an independent publication that is entirely funded by members.
And that's what I think is really the critical part. This stuff costs money, folks. For Steven to do what he does, it costs money. He's got to travel. He's got to produce this stuff. He's got to keep the lights on. Got to feed his family. And I want to make sure we're supporting his work. I don't want this site and this important reporting to go away. Steven, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again. I look forward to next week.